Call to order the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. We always know it's kind of a rough start here because our last committee always leaves late, and then as a result, we always get started a few minutes late. We're hoping to end on time. Members, there's a couple things in your packets. There's a new spreadsheet. Is it in the packets? Okay. When our fiscal analyst gets back, we'll have that in your packets. There's also a Child Care Works community conversation on QRIS in your packet. And there's also information about the Dr. Anda dinner next week on Wednesday the 24th. If you have seen him, he's excellent. He was at the retreat that was out in Chanhassen. So if you can have, if you get the opportunity to go to that dinner, I think it's well worth your time. Of course, we hope we're not in session and anything else. I think it's Wednesday night should be pretty good after caucus. Let's see, Ms. Adrians, are you ready? Do you want to just say a note about the new spreadsheet?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The only thing I should mention about the spreadsheet is everything that you hear from the agencies should be in here. The only thing I have to apologize for, though, is I did not include the breakdown of the aid payment shifts, which the governor recommends extending those, making it 73-27. So there's a note under each of them where it says, for example, ECFE payment shift, but there's no number in there. We're still trying to figure out what those numbers will be broken down. So that's the only part that's not included, and I'm sorry about that, but I'll include that, and I'll hopefully have a new spreadsheet for you on Tuesday, next Tuesday, that includes those numbers.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Okay, we need approval of the minutes. Representative Greiling?
Madam Chair, I recommend approval of the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Greiling moves approval of the minutes for February 16th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and the minutes for February 16th are attached. With that, we will get into the testimony, members, that is on here. We have testimony from the Department of Education, from Assistant Commissioner Klinzing. Then we'll have the Department of Human Services with Chuck Johnson, and then we have a number of providers here. I see that we have a big audience today. So thank you all for coming, and we look forward to the testimony in a few minutes. I see the Assistant Commissioner just got here. Would you like us to take Human Services first? Okay. So with that, Commissioner Chuck Johnson, we know this can be a bad time of the day for traffic and a number of things. All the information, members, is in your budget book, so hopefully you will guide us through that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck Johnson with Department of Human Services, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. I'm not sure exactly how the book you have is organized. I believe there are four pages that the department provided that relate to the Department of Human Services budget under the early childhood jurisdiction. And the first one that I have is called Count SSI Income for MPIP and Child Care Assistance. Do you have that?
And members, it's under the government Governor's Supplemental DHS tab, so a couple tabs back. And if you flip over from the blue page to the first white page, page one, I think we're on the same page.
Okay, Madam Chair, it's my page three, but that's okay. I'll try to keep track.
Oh, okay. I guess, hold on. So it is it you're doing the reduced funding for basic sliding fee?
No, Madam Chair, I think your page number is just different than mine, but okay. I think we'll be able to keep on track.
Okay, just let us know where you are, okay?
Madam Chair, I'm talking about the page titled Count SSI Income for MPIP and Child Care Assistance.
Okay, hold on. That is on page four.
Okay.
Makes page you wonder four, who has the different set of numbers, but I guess
Madam Chair, mine
now.
Is ordered in the set that was given to the Human Services Committees. I'm not sure why they switched it around when they gave it to you, but
okay. We're not sure either. So if you'd like to proceed.
Madam Chair, this page affects MFIP, the Cash Assistance Program for Low-Income Families, and the Child Care Assistance Program. It changes the way that we count SSI, which is Supplemental Security Income, Disability Income paid by the federal government, and MSA, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, which is a Supplemental Disability Assistance paid by the state. Currently, we don't count SSI or MSA income in determining eligibility or benefits for MFIP. For child care assistance, we do count MSA, the state-funded portion. We do not count SSI, the federal disability assistance. What this proposal would do is change the way that we treat those income streams and count them for the purpose of determining eligibility and benefits for both MFIP and child care assistance. For child care assistance, this would be effective in March of 11. As I said, it will be counting SSI. This aligns with the way we count other unearned income, which is to say we count other unearned income dollar for dollar. We also count RSDI, which is disability assistance that you get through the Social Security system. We count dollar for dollar. There's historic reasons why SSI was treated differently. We're proposing here to treat it in the same way. It also aligns across programs, so we're counting income the same for MFIP child care and the food stamp program. For child care assistance, the impact of this change would be higher co-pays for 450 families in the MFIP and transition year program and 350 families in the basic sliding fee program. I believe that those are in the document you have in front of you, probably in the last paragraph. Additionally, we estimate that in the out years of 12 and 13, there'll be 60 to 100 fewer families on child care assistance because we are counting this income. And Madam Chair, you can also see on the page, there's much larger savings associated with the MFIP side of this for child care assistance. The savings are $116,000 in FY11 and then growing to almost $2 million by FY13.
Members, any questions? Yesterday Commissioner Ludeman was testifying before the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, and he did say it used to be counted this way. Is that a correct statement, right? Is that kind of what you were saying, or we calculated part of it this way?
Madam Chair, we used to count part of SSI for MFIP. We did that for a period of time, and that was repealed, I believe, in 2008. It's been, in the MFIP side, it's been something that's been on and off depending on the budget situation as to whether we count it or don't count it.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, and I apologize to the commissioner because I was half paying attention trying to catch up because I got here late. So I apologize for that. So I didn't catch the your last statement about how many families would be impacted and or providers. Can you share that again?
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, the effect is on families having to pay a higher copay because we're counting more of their income. So it's 450 MFIP transition year families and 350 basic sliding fee families who would have higher copays because we are counting the SSI income. And then additionally, we estimate that in 12 and 13, we'd have fewer families on assistance, 60 to 100 fewer families on assistance.
And Madam Chair and Commissioner, any sense of what kind of impact that might then have on the provider side? Or is that difficult to tell at this point?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, I don't have an exact way to address that. Certainly a higher copay for a low-income family is going to stretch them more to have to pay a copay, so it may have an impact in terms of providers not getting fully paid, people having to switch to lower-cost care or another kind of care if they can no longer afford where they had been.
Thank you.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, when we cut this before and then replaced it or got some of it back, as I recall. When that happened before, what was the pattern of statistics as far as how many families actually stopped having qualified child care?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, we haven't done this in child care assistance before. We did it in MFIP and not in child care assistance, so we don't have any experience to look back on as to what the impact of this would be.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you. Is it Commissioner Johnson? Yes. What happened then with MFIP was, what kind of numbers of children that were getting appropriate child care ended up in staying home with older siblings or something like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, it didn't affect child care assistance directly. It affected how much the family received in MFIP benefits. It didn't change the family's eligibility for child care or for the amount of child care. It affected the amount of cash assistance they received through the MFIP program.
Representative Peterson?
Just thank you, Ms. Chair, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up with that. Do you have any record whether any of those small businesses went out of business as a result of those decreases? But the providers, in other words. But they are businesses, small businesses. Did they go under as a result of not getting these kinds or the drop in assistance?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, we don't have any experience with an impact on child care assistance. We only have experience with impact on the MFIP benefits that are paid to families. So we don't have, I can't go to any experience there as to what the impact may have been on providers. The number of families here is relatively small, about 18,000 families in the child care assistance program, so the 450, 350 isn't a large percentage, certainly, but it'll be a matter of how they're concentrated, I assume, in any given provider as to what the impact would be.
Okay, thank you. If you'd proceed.
Madam Chair, the next page that I have, is called Reduce Funding for Basic Sliding Fee Child Care Assistance.
Okay, that would be our page 3, members.
There's actually two that have very similar titles. The one that I'm looking at is Capturing Basic Sliding Fee Underspending. This shows a $5 million savings in 2010. As has happened over the last several years, we've had the counties underspent their basic sliding fee child care allocations in 2009. We estimate there's $5 million available from the underspending from 2009. This proposal, as we proposed in past years, we would capture and use to offset the general fund deficit. Madam Chair, we are proposing to take the savings in TANF from the basic sliding fee program. That's because we are under the non-supplantation rules from the Stimulus Act in 2010, and so we don't believe we can take general fund out of the program. We're taking TANF out instead. The TANF would then be refinanced to produce the general fund savings. This would affect 470 families. Under law, underspending in 1 year from basic sliding fee carries forward into the next year. So under law, this should be going back out to the counties for additional basic sliding fee. By not doing that, we would impact eligibility of 470 families who could potentially receive assistance.
Okay. I'm trying to figure this out, Mr. Johnson. So you're taking the underspending, you're using it towards the deficit, and then you're taking the future underspending and you're using it towards TANF? Did I get that
Madam
right?
Madam Chair, not exactly. We have, right now, basic sliding fee is funded with general fund, CCDF, federal money, and TANF money. And so we overall had underspending of $5 million within the child care assistance program. We have the choice of how we want to take that money out. As I said before, we can't take it out in general fund because of the stimulus non-supplantation rules that we're under. So we're choosing to take it in TANF, which we can refinance and turn into general fund savings.
I see.
So it's somewhat more convoluted than it would be normally, which is usually pretty convoluted to begin with.
Right. And I think the question is, if that $5 million, I thought in statute, is supposed to go back to counties that have the longest waiting lists, is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. There's a manner in which those dollars are redistributed back to counties. And as we've done the last couple of years, we're proposing to intercept the money before it goes back out and use it for to address the deficit.
And so, Mr. Johnson, that's where you get the 470 fewer families? Is that from that?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, so they are not taken off waiting lists. And do you know what would be the biggest waiting list in the state, Hennepin County?
Madam Chair, I don't believe I have information on county-by-county waiting list. We could get that for you. Hennepin has often had the highest, but I can't tell you for sure if they do right now.
I think we would like that if you could send that to us. I think, members, it's you know, this is a dedicated fund, and we're using the funds for child care, and we put into statute that it would be spent back on counties that still had waiting lists, and now it's not going to do that. So one of the big problems, as you know, in this committee and with child care are these waiting lists and trying to gauge an accurate number on what's happening there, because we know a lot of them are in flux as well. Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So relative to those waiting lists, I know one of the testifiers from the Blue Earth County brought their waiting list, and if I remember right, his testimony was that once they actually got back and started working their waiting list, they realized that it was maybe a little bit of there's a chunk of it that's kind of a phantom waiting list that people had come in and inquired or filled out a form once at some point in time, but were not really genuinely in interest or need of the service. So I'm curious whether or not we learned anything as we started to try and kind of clear these waiting lists over the last, whatever, 9 months intervening period of time where we had the funds dedicated to reducing the waiting list. Did we learn anything about how real those waiting lists were and what kind of a reduction we were actually able to make?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Downey, you're correct, and this generally happens with counties when they go to try to reduce the waiting list. They send out applications or notices to the people on the waiting list and find a number of them have moved on. Something else has changed. They're no longer interested or eligible for child care assistance. The number varies in its relation to how long the waiting list has been out there. Potentially, if someone's been on the waiting list for 2 years, they're very unlikely to still need assistance versus if it's a more recent waiting list. I don't have a particular example for what's happened over the last 6 months. I know the waiting list has dropped by about 700 families over the last 6 months. That's presumably in part because we were able to add more people with the stimulus money, but it's also probably in part because, as you said, counties went through their lists and found individuals who are no longer interested or eligible or even living in the county potentially. And that's been true historically, that's what happens when we get into the waiting list. At the time the people apply, they want child care assistance. By the time it's available, they may or may not still be interested or have a need.
Mr. Johnson, I think we're going to have to walk through the budget, but I think the waiting list is a good topic for someday we should discuss. I mean, last year we had the frustrations of the computer, and you have your computer system, and the counties can't use a computer system to track their waiting lists. And, you know, we went to this forum, all of us, on that we do to gear up for the legislative session, and they talked about how technology can really move things forward. And it just seems like, how can we have these families on the waiting list? How can we not know what the status is? How can we have this underspending happening and even have the waiting list? So we'll keep that on our sort of parking lot for another day to address, but it's I'm sure it's a little bit frustrating for you all too, perhaps. We'd really like to just be able to to know the people needing child care or getting it. So please proceed.
Madam Chair, the next page
Sorry, Mr. Johnson, I didn't see Representative Rosenthal. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Could you just go into the time frame that you're talking about from when people request to when you find out that they no longer need the service?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Rosenthal, I may ask for help on that because I'm not sure if there are particular rules around how quickly or what time frame a county needs to use in reviewing their waiting list, or if it's up to the individual county. I'm going to ask Ms. Kotelnik to help me out.
And when you think of little kids and how, you know, early those first 5 years for the most part. If you're on there for a year or two, it's a long time. Ms. Kotelnik, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Sheree Kotelnik, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. Counties are responsible for updating their waiting list numbers once every 6 months, so they have to look at the families on the waiting list. When we had told counties that there was more funds available and they started sending out applications, some counties put parameters around how frequent or how soon the applications had to be submitted to them. They sent out, and I think most of the applications were required to be submitted within 30 days. And then the county has 30 days to look at the application and determine whether the person's eligible and get all the verifications. And if they're eligible, they're eligible back to the date of the application. And then they choose their provider, and they start using services. The provider provides the services. The provider then bills for the services, and then we pay for the services. So there's a period of time between when the original notice goes out and the person actually gets the services and we pay for those services.
Ms. Kotelnik, I think the question would be, if someone got on, how long might they wait in Hennepin County?
How long might the waiting list be?
And how long would their wait be, the family?
Well, Hennepin County right now has 1,800 families on the waiting list, and I don't believe they've had funds available to pull 1,800 families in quite a while.
Representative Rosenthal.
So then when you say that these families no longer require help, it could be from a number of reasons. They're going into kindergarten, their families, maybe parents lost jobs. It's a number of reasons.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
These families are very fluid.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, if you'd like to move forward.
Madam Chair, the next page that I have is reduced state funding for basic sliding fee child care assistance by 5%.
Members, this is page 2.
I'm working exactly backwards from the way you asked. So. Madam Chair, this page it also deals with the basic sliding fee program. This proposes a 5% reduction in the appropriation to the basic sliding fee program. The 5% is calculated on the all funds of the basic sliding fee, not just on the general fund, but the savings is in general fund. It's $4.557 million, and you can see the numbers in the out years roughly similar. You'll also note on this page, Madam Chair, there is a small offset of some families who will stay on MFIP transition year longer because of the unavailability of basic sliding fee that would be created by this reduction. This also results in 470 fewer families being eligible for assistance. And this also interacts with the next page I'll talk about. Those interactions are represented here. And that's the rate reduction.
Why don't you go through the interaction so we can get a announce? What page do you have for that?
Madam Chair, then the next page, which I believe should be the last page you have, is reduced maximum child care assistance rates.
Page 1, so we're back a page. Ours are back-to-back, so we can't see them at the same time.
Madam Chair, this proposal reduces the maximum rates in the child care assistance program by 5%. You will recall that we set maximum rates in the child care assistance program that we will pay up to that level for care for a child. Those rates vary by county and region, by the type of care, by the age of children. The rates were frozen in 2003. Prior to that, they'd gone up every year based on a formula that followed what was happening in the market. Since 2003, there have been a couple of increases to them, but we've fallen behind where the market is. And certainly this reduction would put us further behind where the market is. We currently estimate, based on 2009 survey data of the child care market, that our rates cover 40% of family child care and 32.9% of center-based care in the state. There's a lot of variation across counties and regions when you look at that because the rates haven't been frozen for so long. We've ended up with odd situations across the state where we may be closer to the market or really well behind the market because we haven't done anything to adjust back to the market rates. So, Madam Chair, this is the reduction to 5% results in savings in this biennium of $1.9 million and $8.9 million a year in the out years. The effective date on this is proposed as March 1st of 2011.
Mr. Johnson, it's supposed to be the 75th percentile, right? Is that, you know, what's hard about this page is that a child is a child is a child, and when a child is receiving a subsidy, they're not supposed to be treated than a child that is not receiving a subsidy. Yet by the state reimbursing less, we're treating the child different, and the provider, of course, is getting treated different as well. What is the market rate supposed to be?
Madam Chair, we survey the market to find out what market rates are, different regions, different types of care across the state. There's federal guidance about how to set rates, which suggests the 75th percentile of the market is where rates should be set. Very few states are actually doing that, and we certainly haven't been since about 2002. And as a result, as you're suggesting, we end up with rates that fully cover care, as I said, in 40% of the family care that are on the state and about a third of the center-based care, but for the other 60% and two-thirds respectively, we're paying less than what those programs are charging. That doesn't mean that a child care assistance family can't go to that program, but it does mean that the family or someone has to pay for the differential between the maximum rate that we pay and whatever the provider actually charges, which would be in addition to the family's copay if, in fact, they have a copay. So that certainly puts a strain on the family. Sometimes providers step in and try to help with that, create scholarships, things like that. Obviously, that puts a strain on them as well in terms of trying to keep kids enrolled.
Mr. Johnson, I know we have a lot of providers in the room today. I think that, you know, here we are saying to our providers, yeah, you're just going to get paid less. And, you know, well, here we're in this economy, on and on, but where we're trying to create jobs and the revving up the economy is our biggest and highest priority. And we're saying to these small business owners, we're not going to reimburse you as much. And so I think it's a and what becomes the breaking point. I know the margin levels aren't real high in terms of what they're how they're doing right now. Representative Downey?
Actually, no, I'll pass and wait. Okay.
Any other questions on that or the page before? And is that, so are you finished then? Is that
your Madam Chair, I believe I am.
Another one, Ms. Kotelnik?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out that the December basic sliding fee waiting list was posted on the DHS website today.
Okay.
So the waiting list by county for the whole state is on the website now.
Do you remember the number on that, Ms. Kotelnik?
It's 6,223 for the total waiting list number, and 1,800 in Hennepin County and 1,200 in Ramsey County.
And what's your website?
If you go to MNDHS, you'll get to the DHS website, and then click on child care, and you'll get to our waiting list.
Members, if you want to follow that, then we would know how to get there. Representative Kulik-Jackson?
So if I'm to understand correctly, we have well over 6,000 families on waiting lists, and we have $5 million that's unused, and we cannot marry the two. I don't, you know, call me blonde, but I don't get it.
It's a new phrase, Representative Kulik-Jackson, that we haven't heard in committee before. But yes, it does make you wonder. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to that point, is the inability to match that money to the waiting list based on program parameters, or is that because of the decision that we're making to utilize those funds to balance the budget?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Downey, I think it's based on what happens when you take money and split it up 87 different ways. You just create a certain amount of inefficiency in how it's you're able to spend the money. And we're reliant on counties to track and monitor where their spending is and who they're serving. And counties are somewhat risk averse because if they spend too much, they're stuck then having to pay out county funds for any differential. And it's not a terribly efficient way to try to make sure that all the money is getting spent. If you're trying to manage anything, you want to minimize variables, and 87 variables is a lot of variables to try to manage.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So just, this is the same problem we had last year, right? I mean, how do counties manage their waiting list and avail themselves of these funds under those circumstances? Is that a fair statement?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, that's a fair statement.
Well, members, it makes you wonder if it should be centralized. I know we have that debate about a lot of different services. You, Mr. Johnson, we seem to think you missed page 6, the TANF refinancing to the general fund.
Madam Chair, I can speak to that if you'd like me to.
Yes.
I mentioned earlier in the context of the underspending for basic sliding fee that we're taking that in TANF and refinancing it. There are four items on this page where we are taking TANF and refinancing it to create general fund savings. The basic sliding fee underspending, which I mentioned earlier, the savings on the MFIP program from the MFIP program on the SSI counting proposal, which I discussed. And two items which I have not discussed here. One is a $28 million TANF earnings that we have available to us under the Stimulus Act. The federal government gave us an interpretation the last couple of months that we're able to earn some TANF off of increases in refundable tax credits. And because we've had some growth in Minnesota in our working family credit, we're able to earn some TANF there. We're proposing to take that TANF and refinance it to help with the general fund deficit. And then the fourth area is there's some TANF administrative reductions to some of the TANF we use for the department's administration. We are also proposing to refinance that. We refinanced TANF because that takes the TANF federal money and essentially creates general fund savings for the state. So that's the purpose of doing the refinance. And the refinance in this case does not involve the child care assistance program. In the past, we have refinanced through child care assistance. We're proposing this year to be doing the refinancing through the working family credit.
Okay. Mr. Johnson, will the TANF transfers affect the maintenance of effort requirements?
Madam Chair, no. We'll continue to meet all of our maintenance of effort requirements under this proposal.
We know this, members, has been done a few times, and many times in the past several years. It still doesn't make it any easier. These are funds that should be spent on child care and kids, and we use them to pay off the deficit, which we seem to have a deficit many years in a row. I guess one last question, and we can, unless members have questions, move on to MDE. I asked this to Commissioner Ludeman yesterday in Health and Human Services Finance, but could you share with us the philosophy of how you decided what to cut and the level? So I think there's sort of a 5% level and a, you know, when you're looking at your budget, and members, please know that Mr. Johnson was very good about sharing last time how they made their decisions. I wondered if you could share how you made your decisions this time.
Madam Chair, each department starts with a target, which I believe was based on a 6% estimate by MMB. In our case, then, we do targets internally on this as well. We were restricted to some extent by the maintenance of effort requirements in the Medicaid program for what changes we could make in the healthcare side of our business. And you look at the spreadsheet for DHS reductions, there's a lot in healthcare, so I'm not saying that we weren't able to make reductions in healthcare, but that was one restriction to where we could go. And within my part of the business area, I think if you look through the major programs that we have in Children and Family Services, every major program has taken a fairly sizable reduction. We have several programs that address adults, MSA, group residential housing, general assistance. With the first two, we took as many reductions as we could, given the federal maintenance of effort that we have to meet in those programs. We proposed to eliminate the general assistance program. On the children's side of my business, we have the MFIT program, and you saw the level of reduction we put in for that with counting SSI and MSA, which is around 10% of our total in MFIT grants that we pay families. You've seen the reductions to the child care program that are here. The governor unallotted CCSA, which is the major funding source for child welfare, child protection services, last year, proposing to continue that in the base. So basically all of the major areas that we have, given the target we had to go and take some fairly large reductions in order to come up with the money that we needed to address the target.
Thank you. And we know that from Finance Committee there's $387 million, I think, that's credited towards coming in from the feds. If that doesn't come in, are we going to see more cuts in Health and Human Services?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Johnson, have you been approached about working on that?
Madam Chair, no, I have not.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Next, we'd like to have the Department of Education come up. Assistant Commissioner Klensing. And are they in the same place? This is a separate MDE tab. If you can look for your MDE tab. One back. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Klensing. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. And I don't have the page number, but it is on the version that I have. If I heard right, you have an MDE tab.
Yes, and we have no page numbers either. So
okay, good.
Hopefully they match the
well,
same.
And the reason for that is we were still correcting some errors yesterday, so we're really glad you were able to get the newest version. I'm here to speak about the early childhood, the effects on the early childhood portions of the budget for the early learning programs. And the one I will point you to is the the operating budget reduction, which does show a 3% reduction to the Educate Parents Partnership website in the kindergarten entrance assessment. those are the only two effects that on the early learning programs. And that was a across-the-board 3% cut for all state agencies and programs within the state agencies that the state agencies administer.
Do members have any questions? Commissioner Klinzing, it's concerning, you know, sometimes when we see things in the budget and we think, is this going to show up somewhere else? Is it your belief, I guess, that the entrance assessment will be carried out to the fullest degree, the same type of sample, the 10%? And because 1 year, I remember that didn't happen. Is that fully slated to happen this year? Or probably happened last fall, and will it happen next year?
We don't see any expected change in service for the kindergarten entrance assessment to the public. We'll take some administrative cuts in our budget back at the agency. Sometimes we would hire interns to help with some of the administrative tasks, and we will absorb the cost of that instead. So you'll still have the same size sample.
And will the training on the assessment be affected at all?
There are no plans to affect the training at this point.
Members, any questions? I just wanted to ask you a question about, the governor was asked if there were any cuts to early ed, and he said no. And I know he's got a lot to deal with this budget. But in our committee, we deal with both, as you know, your part and the DHS part. And while these are minimal, the DHS cuts are pretty darn big. So we just hope that the message of early care can obviously go through the Department of Education, but can also be used in the Department of Human Services. And I guess I can't ask yet what the governor's thinking, because we don't know that. Sometimes I think we do want to know that. Do we want to know? But we would if we would like him to understand, if it ever comes up, that we see all of this as early care, not just your part. I have to say, along with that, we're glad to see there's not a big cut in MDE. I know back in 2003 they did go into the these programs, so we appreciate that they're not touched this time.
Yeah, we're happy to report early learning at the Department of Education's in good form going into the next budget cycle.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Next, we will have the public testimony. First, I would like to call you up in. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I defer this until after the MDE testimony was given, and I just wanted to say that I'm glad that we're getting down to the real discussion here for this legislative session, which is how are we going to navigate this $1.2 billion deficit, and how do we position ourselves for the next biennium, which, I mean, we can all see this coming, right? I mean, take away the stimulus money from these spreadsheets, and yeah, there's some strings attached to the bailout money that allow us or don't allow us to do certain things, so maybe we'll have some more flexibility next time around. But I think we need to take a serious look as a committee at what we're going to do to position ourselves for next year. And you know, I've voiced some of my concerns about why we would think about rolling out QRIS. It's $50 million a year. In my mind, there's not yet documented or substantiated evidence of value to it. And now we have these numbers staring us in the face. And I guess I would just encourage us as a committee, Maybe we should embark on a bit of a reform agenda here, as compared to thinking that we can just keep pouring money through these same old vehicles and distribute them through the same old mechanisms and get the bang for the buck that we're going to want to get 2 years from now. So I don't know what that means. I don't have a whiteboard with a bunch of diagrams drawn out that say, here's how we'd solve these problems. But boy, this is just a small taste, right? I mean, when we get it back and frankly, Madam Chair, I would look forward to getting some targets from the majority for this fiscal year so that we could compare alternative strategies to resolving this for this biennium. And I guess if you win your lawsuit, we've got an even bigger problem to solve. You know, what will be the result of that on the governor's unallotment? So I just think we've got some major fiscal challenges here, and that some creative thinking applied to them would be really warranted. And you know, hearing the the providers testify again. We'll continue to memorialize the problem, but I'd really suggest maybe we can meet offline to talk about some ways that we could really think about more fundamentally reforming what we're doing in a way that would reduce the damage a year from now.
Well, I'm going to respond, but I would like to have Chad Dunkley and Miranda Oliver come down as well. We'll kind of take you in threes. Representative Downey, I think the members on this side of the table, and I guess we wind up, you have free seating, and so Representative Lane is over there. So we are bipartisan. I think we are well aware of the problems of this budget as well as what's coming. I think for all of us as members, it's a struggle because as we heard at the Humphrey Institute and as we know, it's going to be a new normal, and the new normal is less. I mean, I think that's the way it is. We are working hard on a reform agenda. We have a group of from the philanthropic community that's working with us on that, United Way, Minneapolis Foundation. They were going to be here last week and had to cancel. They'll be here in the coming week. They are doing everything. They have a strategic plan, which incorporates some of things like Representative Peterson's office bill, make a smaller office, less staff. It has things like a report card on early childhood, those types of things. We are definitely looking at a reform agenda and what we can do differently. I think it's going to be a very difficult year. It feels like it's April. I don't know about all of you, but it feels like we're really advanced on our discussions. Representative Greiling, Chair Greiling, as a fiscal chair, as I am a fiscal chair, we are meeting regularly, and we will have targets soon. I'm not sure, members, if having targets is going to be easier or harder. It's going to crystallize the challenge, which, you know, we know is before us, but it hasn't been divvied up yet. And as we divvy up targets, the reality will set in of where we just frankly have to get. So I think you'll see the discussion coming. Representative Downey, we're in discussions, all of our members, very seriously concerned. We know the days, you know, of doing things the way we've always done them have changed. But, you know, part of what we do here at the legislature as well is we involve the public. I don't think we're memorializing the cuts. I think these are their businesses. We're a place that's trying to grow the economy. These folks are out there trying to work with our kids and run their businesses, and we're not making it any easy for them. So that's part of what we have to do here today, too, is as people that respond, the public is our boss, are you guys, you know, and to hear from you on what you're thinking about this particular part of the budget. As you know, we'll be doing it on every part of the budget. So with that, I'd like to proceed. Oh, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Downey, I really appreciate your questions and input and value your opinion very much. I just want to correct a couple things and make a comment as well. First of all, you said that what you referenced was if we win our lawsuit. We don't have a lawsuit. I just want you to be clear that we don't have a lawsuit. I don't think there's anybody at this table that has a lawsuit. There is a lawsuit. There is a court case regarding the unallotments. But I really want to point out that, you know, nobody wins in that situation, period. And nobody at this table is. I'm not a part of that lawsuit. Neither is anybody else here, including you, I don't think. The second thing I want to comment on is since I came down here in 2007, we have worked, and you as well, we have worked very hard to make sure that early childhood family education, child care, has been a priority down here. We had a national summit here. We've worked our tails off to try to show that if we invest early, we're going to recover big bucks, period, and you know that. And the thought of doing nothing, the thought of moving from the severe 2003 cuts to where we are now, and we're still not where we should be, you know, and not doing anything, it's similar to, I sit on another committee that public safety that has had huge dialogue about the sex offender program and trying to be preventive rather than reactive. And we know that when we're preventive, it's much more fiscally wise and fiscally responsible. Same thing holds for child care, too, and family ed, and early ed, and family ed, and family ed care as well. So I really hope that all of our dialogue is cooperative, collaborative, and evolves around trying to find solutions, especially for this area, in the preventive area, because that's fiscally wise, fiscally responsible, and smart for the future of all of our state. So I really, and your input is valuable. Your questions are legit and very well pointed and everything, but I want us to be able to all work together to come up with possible solutions and not just say, well, we can't do anything. We can't, I mean, it's tough because if we don't do anything, we're going to pay a big price down the road, in my opinion. Remember, I just wanted to point that out.
We're going to need to move forward. Some of this dialogue is good, although we always have our agenda as well that we need to go through. I know we have a parent here. I'm going to ask her to come down. I'm going to ask one of you to, if you can sit in the back chairs, and if Alexis can come down. I suppose Chad being the gentleman, if you, because she has to leave by 5:30. So why don't we go Susie and then Alexis and then Miranda, and then we'll bring Chad back up.
Sure. Okay. So,
welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thanks so much for this opportunity to talk to you today about the proposed cuts by the governor to child care. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the executive director of Child Care Works, and we're a coalition of organizations and individuals who work together to increase access, affordability, and quality of child care in Minnesota. We work with many partner groups, and I want to let you know today that one of our major partners, Ready for K, is in support of the testimony that we're delivering today. First, I'd like to begin by showing my appreciation to this committee and the entire legislature for preventing cuts in early childhood last session. We understand that the budget woes continue and are very serious, and that critical decisions will be made in the coming weeks. We also understand that there are really important decisions to be made in other areas, including health and education. We would like to be a resource to you as you go forward with these important discussions. Today I'd like to describe the ways that particularly the proposed cut to the rate affects child care in Minnesota by eroding the integrity of the child care assistance program, by harming small businesses, by leading to job losses, and disrupting the lives of thousands of Minnesotans, particularly families with young children and small business owners. In Minnesota, most of our young children are in child care settings, whether it's a center, licensed family child care, or with family, friends, and neighbors. About 3/4 of Minnesota families with children under the age of 13 regularly use some type of child care, and over 360,000 children spend some portion of their day in a licensed care setting. In 2003, the Child Care Resource and Referral Network, in partnership with the National Economic Development and Law Center, issued a report on the economic impact of the child care industry in Minnesota. In that report, three key points were made about the way that child care affects Minnesota's economy. There's a current and immediate impact on the economy by supporting working parents as they stay employed. There's a long-term impact on the economy by providing quality programs that prepare children for school and reducing costs of a long range of social issues in the future. And a point that's often lost in the discussion, although has been raised several times already today, childcare itself is a major small business contributor to the economy, providing jobs for over 36,000 employees and small business owners and generating $1 billion per year in the state's economy. As you'll hear from providers, child care programs already operate on the thinnest of margins, and in some areas they operate at a loss. Due to the freeze on provider reimbursement rates for child care assistance in 2003, even with the small increases that have occurred since then, Minnesota is nowhere near covering the market rates. Our system is intended to offer choices for parents, and in fact, the federal government requires that we do so. In 2005, parents had access to around 55% of the child care market. And we were sent a warning letter from the federal government that said we should establish pay based on market rates, and without doing so, we were not providing equal access. We understand from recent testimony from Commissioner Johnson that 32% of centers and 40% of family child care providers will be within reach in the future should this cut go forward, unless the family or program can pay the difference. In 2001, by comparison, more than 80% of all child care providers fell within the reach of families making use of the child care assistance program. As a result of 2003 cuts and the lack of substantial investments in child care since then, we have seen a net loss of nearly 2,000 licensed child care programs in Minnesota between 2003 and 2009. We've seen over 2,800 programs close in the last 2 years alone. This is roughly 4,200 jobs lost and the disruption to the lives of over 8,000 families. Every closing has multiple impacts: the loss of a small business, the loss of a job or several jobs, the loss of continuity in provider training, and the loss of stability for the family, and the interruption of close relationships that have been built with the children and the critical adults in their lives. The governor's recommendation to cut 5% of the reimbursement rate will further erode the already crumbling integrity of the program. Providers will be forced to choose between passing on the additional cost to parents or accepting a decreased rate, threatening the financial health of their small business. Passing on the cost to parents makes childcare out of reach for many families for whom the cost of care is disproportionately high. While upper-income families generally pay about 7% of their income for childcare expenses, lower-income families pay closer to 30%. The lowest-income families count on the Child Care Assistance Program to make childcare a possibility. Increasing their out-of-pocket costs makes this opportunity out of reach for many, forcing them to choose between staying in the workforce and settling for care that may be less safe and reliable, or leaving the workforce to care for their children themselves. Based on available data, after previous cuts, many Minnesota families may choose the latter and rejoin the MFIP program and other government programs if faced with additional child care costs that are out of reach and cause them to lose their jobs.
Are you almost finished?
Yes, I am. Okay. Unfortunately, previous experience shows that many providers who primarily care for children from low to moderate income families will choose to simply close their doors or lay off employees. There will be little financial incentive to care for these children, and they will be operating with a business model that's not financially sustainable. Many providers will no longer be able to care for CCAP children because they will not have access to the resources to cover the full costs. Finally, I just want to reiterate that our significant concern is about the erosion of the integrity of the program and the impact that has on the folks that should be most supported in these tough times, families with small children, and those who own small businesses. Thank you.
Thank you. And we want to make sure we get Alexis. It's 5:26, so I hope you can give your testimony. We're glad you're here, and we know you have other responsibilities too. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. As you all heard, my name is Alexis Mann, and I'm a parent of two children in the YWCA Downtown Child Care Center. I have an 18-year-old daughter who went to the YWCA when she was in preschool. She's now in college. I also have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old daughter who are both currently using the Child Care Center now. I had my first child when I was entering my junior year in high school, and thanks to child care funding, I was able to earn my high school diploma. And without my high school diploma, I would not have been able to go on to college. And graduating from college was very important to me because of the constant hardships I faced as a single mother and the extremely limited income I was able to earn. Living in abject poverty was my motivation to pursue a career that would lead me to financial stability. And child care has been my savior as far as providing a way to make ends meet for my family. And my education has greatly paid off. I was able to qualify for a job as a paralegal years ago, and I earned more than 2 times more than I was making before. Unfortunately, I lost that job as a paralegal because of the economy. Because of my education, I've been able to find work and make ends meet on a limited income, but still more than I was earning before. And this is why child care assistance is important, because without child care assistance, I wouldn't have that reduction in my payments, and I wouldn't be able to provide child care for my children, and I wouldn't be able to continue working. And it would be a great detriment to my children, who really have reaped great benefits from going to the YWCA. As I said, my 18-year-old is in college. My 6-year-old has moved up 6 reading levels in the last 4 months. She's in first grade. My 4-year-old is making great strides in learning how to read, learning how to write her name. She takes pride every day in trying to be the star student. My children all take school very seriously, and I credit that to the great program that they're involved in at the YWCA. I'm now pursuing my master's in special education, hoping to add more stability and income eventually down the line. But I'm also doing something that I really enjoy, and I think that it's important because I work as a reserve teacher now, but in my job I see kids that have a lot of issues, I mean, from all age ranges, and I see where I can make a difference. And I also see where perhaps they may have had a better opportunity to be better students if they may have started early or had access to child care options when they were younger. Without child care funding and the YWCA's child care center, I would, without question, be on the brink of homelessness, helplessness, and failure. The YWCA has provided child care grants when I didn't qualify for state funding based on going back to school. And when there was no state funding available, I personally waited on the waiting list recently for about 15 months because I went back to school and they kicked me off daycare. So the YWCA came through and provided me with a grant so that my kids could stay in daycare, and I'm receiving limited funding from the state for daycare, which is set to be cut again because my children's father wants to go to school. And he only has a GED, so he really needs additional training. Nevertheless, I'm here to implore this committee to do what you can, as you have before, to protect child care funding from the proposed cuts and consider other options. And I just want to say that I think you all understand the impact of not having child care funding and how it has a ripple effect on businesses and communities and families. And I really am happy that you all take this so seriously. And that's all I want to share.
Well, thank you. We very much appreciate you coming here. I have to appreciate you've overcome a lot of hurdles. There's a lot of teen moms that never graduate from high school even. So to be hearing you're getting your master's is fantastic.
It's
so
because of child care funding, madam.
Yeah, it the stability for your kids and being able to have them in a good situation while you're able to be more self-sufficient. So we very much appreciate that. Members, any questions? Well, it's 5:31, so we got you out almost on time. Thank you for coming down.
Well, they're pretty flexible, so.
You're lucky, because some aren't as much. So, thanks. We'll have Chad if you want to come up, and you'll go. Let's have Miranda and then Chad. Welcome to the committee. Or is Miranda right?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak about the impact the governor's proposed budget cut to the child care assistance program will have on child care providers. I'm Miranda Oliver, president of the board of the Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association, also known as MLF-CCA, and a licensed accredited family child care provider. Although I do not currently have children in my program that are on child care assistance, I would like to explain some of the implications these cuts may have and speak on behalf of providers throughout the state of Minnesota. MLF-CCA is a professional family child care organization of licensed family child care providers serving children and family child care providers. MLF-CCA's mission is to support the highest standard of care for children in Minnesota's diverse licensed family child care homes through education, resources, recognition, and advocacy. The MLF-CCA provides the infrastructure for all of our statewide counties and county associations to meet, and we are the link for providers to the National Family Child Care Association, of which we are an affiliate. First of all, I believe it is important to understand that each family child care provider actually represents a small business in Minnesota. There are approximately 12,000 family child care businesses in the state. These providers care for 187,000 children, which is slightly more than half of all the children cared for in licensed child care in the state of Minnesota. The child care and education industry in Minnesota has gross receipts of well over $900 million, one of the top industries in the state of Minnesota. Besides the tax revenue this industry provides Minnesota, it is the industry that allows workers in all other jobs the ability to work by providing care and education for their children. Family child care providers purchase food, equipment, and business services that keep so many other tax revenue industries alive. Reducing the child care and assistance program reimbursements results in family child care providers losing income and forcing them to make reductions in their programs that may lead to the demise of their businesses. Many family child care providers who have children that receive child care assistance, CCAP, have expressed to me their concerns regarding the lack of funding and the lack of early childhood support. Many of them feel that current reimbursement rates are already inadequate. If the governor's proposed cuts come to fruition, providers may be forced to turn away children on CCAP, charge the families the difference that they are not receiving from the CCAP program, or cut items from their programs. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to give you a specific example from my program, my own business, regarding the CCAP waiting list. It was addressed a little bit earlier about waiting list. I have had a child care family that has been on the waiting list for over 13 months. It's a single dad with two children. In order to provide affordable care for this family, I provided child care for no charge for one of the children, roughly 10% of my business income. My business suffered directly from this by a loss of income and is not something that I may consider in the future due to the strain it created for my specific business. With the current economic state, family child care providers are already struggling to run their small businesses. Again, I'd like to remind you there are roughly 12,000 family child care providers in the state of Minnesota. Several have already been forced to close their doors, and several more are on the verge of closing. With the closing of any business, the state loses its much-needed business tax revenues. Governor Pawlenty's proposed cuts to the child care assistance program perpetuate the downward spiral, making many working families unable to provide care for their children. Cutting CCAP will directly decrease child care and education access for working families. Raising the copay for parents and increasing the waiting list for families seeking assistance results in many parents making the decision not to work at all because they can't afford the cost of care. What happens then? Minnesota loses more tax revenue and families look for assistance programs whose cost to the state is higher. Or worse, these families may continue working and put their children in situations that may jeopardize child safety and well-being. Please consider how to keep people working. This is what Minnesota does and needs. Look at increasing revenue by maintaining and creating jobs, not by cutting the programs that allow workers to work. Although I have been asked to speak to the economic impact of this decision, the most important consideration is the impact on children. Family child care providers cannot keep children whose parents cannot pay their bills. No business can function without income. Currently, these children often get bounced from provider to provider once it is evident that they will not be paying their copays, and this practice will increase if the cuts are made. We know continuity of care is crucial to quality early childhood care. Continuity of care is what is so unique about family child care. The same person always takes care of your child. How can we begin to talk about quality if we are not supporting the base that allows access for low-income families to have care? Madam Chair and committee members, to recap, if the child care assistance program is cut, a major Minnesota industry, 12,000 small business owners of family child care, will be negatively affected, potentially resulting in less child care options for working parents as well as a loss of revenue to the state of Minnesota. Two, working families will suffer as more of them will not be able to afford quality child care. Three, most importantly, children, 187,000 of them who are in licensed family child care, will suffer as they lose continuity of care and the base of quality child care access. Results, negative impact on school readiness, future workforce, and potential stress for some of our most vulnerable children. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. I think that very compelling. If you have a copy of your testimony, I think I would like one.
I will email you.
And also from Susie Brown, if she's got a copy, I would like a copy of that as well. And so can I ask what county you live in?
Washington.
So you had a parent on the waiting list for 13 months?
It's a family that lives in Anoka County. Okay. I'm 2 miles from the Anoka County border. So.
Did that change yet, or are they still?
They are still on the waiting list, and in fact, the family is actually working in Duluth, and the children are staying with grandparents.
To stay in that area?
To keep the family together.
Mm. Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming. And I met you in the, is that you?
Yes.
Yeah.
At the Girl Scouts.
I met her the other day outside the chamber with her Girl Scouts. It was Girl Scout Day here at the Capitol. So I know this is a tough time for you to come here and testify. It's right in the with pickups and everything else in traffic.
And so. I apologize that there are not more family child care providers present, but as you stated, 4:30 is a very hard time.
Yes.
They're doing their jobs, so.
So, members, we have to lobby to get this time changed next time because we need a morning time or something. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Chad Dunkley. I'm president of the Minnesota Child Care Association and also chief operating officer of New Horizon Academy. The Minnesota Child Care Association represents 250 child care centers in the state of Minnesota, caring for about 30,000 children a day. My own programs, we have 60 programs started by my parents back in 1971 here in Minnesota and care for about 7,000 children a day. I also employ 1,400 Minnesotans. And I'm really
New Horizons and the Kinderberries, or
and the Kinderberries, correct? Yeah. And I'm really glad, Madam Chair, that you mentioned the governor's comments yesterday. That's pretty hurtful for a guy who's even had some conversations with him about early education, and child care is early education for most families in Minnesota. That's how they experience it, and it's sad if we say we didn't cut early education when you have before you cuts that will have profound impacts on families' early education experience here in this state. And once again, we're here to beg for you not to do this harm, and you in the House have done the most to help at least protect what we have, which is not that much. I understand the governor is proposing a 5% cut, but I actually hear the Senate's proposing a 3% cut in reimbursement rates, and I think that's horrible. I just can't believe that that's being proposed, and I understand everybody's got a lot of pressures here, but I just want to touch on what that might do to the field. The last time I came before a committee here was in 2003 to say, if you do this, a lot of bad things are going to happen, and programs are going to close. And I even said that some new horizons are going to close, and I did. I closed four programs, actually. One was in the Phillips neighborhood in Minneapolis, one was in Richfield, one was in Crystal, and one was in Burnsville. And what the governor's proposing to do here is to say, here, families, we'll give you a voucher. And it's based on a fall 2001 survey. It was, in fact, in place in 2003. But we're going to cut that rate 5%. You go out and make good choices and buy good care that gets your kids ready for school. How do you do that? I mean, when the state buys tape from 3M, they don't say, I'm going to pay you what it costs to buy masking tape in 2001, less 5%, and that's what you get, or you don't get the tape. And families need child care. We can't do this, and you can't give families those options and then expect them to make good choices when they really won't have choices in most communities, particularly for good care. When I said in 2003 we closed programs, if you cut reimbursement rates by 5% on this 9-year-old rate, I will have to leave communities and close programs. And not to pick on Representative Lane, but I have a center in Columbia Heights, and 70% of the families there receive child care assistance. And I am the only 4-star quality program in the city of Columbia Heights. And if you cut rates by 5%, I have to close my center in Columbia Heights. And is that giving families in that community options? And many of you on this committee, I have programs in your communities. There's one in Maplewood. 35% of the families at the center you used to attend get child care assistance. If they get rates cut and they leave my program, I don't operate in Maplewood. That same thing would happen in St. Paul. But surprisingly, people don't understand that families that need help with child care live everywhere in the state of Minnesota. And the same thing can be said of Bloomington and Apple Valley and Savage. I have programs there, and there is a program in each of those communities where 30% of the families get child care help. It's everywhere. Families need help. And if there's 1,400 families that I actually serve on the program. If those 1,400 families don't get me as an option or a quality option in their community, because I'm one of many providers that will be impacted, I'll tell you, a lot of those 1,400 families are going to leave the workforce, because these are families that do care where their kids go. And if they don't have a quality option, they're not going to work. They're not going to put their family and their children, their most prized possession, in a poor quality environment. And that's what we're forcing families to do, when we have all the proof that that's the worst thing they can do. So I'm just telling you that these cuts are serious, and I know we have a little bit of limited time, but I closed my programs on Monday, President's Day, and bring all my staff together for presentations, and one of the presentations was extraordinarily powerful, and I've gone to many on early education, and I provided the handout, and I just wanted to touch on something quick before a final comment, and that is the brain research. Our own, like an economist, come and tell you all the time about the effect of good care in the early years. Well, this is the cause simplified. Page 12 of that handout, on the top, it says Windows of Opportunity. And this was the best, most concise discussion of brain research. It looks like this, if you're looking for it.
Yep.
And it shows how the brain works, and it separates it into a few categories. The first is, and it's about, you hear synapses, or the wiring of a brain. In the first 4 years of life, that's when the main wiring occurs in a child's brain. And that includes areas like emotional intelligence, social development, thinking skills, motor development, vision, and reading skills. If that wiring does not happen in those first 4 years, it can never happen. And we can't go into the brain and fix it. That includes vision. That includes lots of things. The main wiring occurs in those first 4 years, and the greatest enhancement time for children happen from 2 years, typically till 8, in some categories up to 12 years. And then we can further enhance all of those connections that we have for the rest of our lifetimes. But if those connections don't happen, they never will. And what we're proposing here, and I know you're faced with a $1.2 billion problem, and none of you are likely to agree on a solution for solving it, but I would think that all of you would want to do something that you can fix a year or two from now. And if you're going to have cuts, do something that doesn't have permanent damage. And cutting child care funding like this proposal is permanent damage. and it's permanent damage to communities like Columbia Heights and many of your communities you live in when providers, who may be the last remaining good one that will take at-risk families, leave. It will do damage to jobs. Child care is a double effect on the workforce. Those 1,400 families I serve go to work every day. That's why they use me. And I have 300 staff that care for those 1,400 children that if they don't come to me, I have to lay them off. So it's a double effect on the economy. But not just that. The children that we're talking about, let's say you decide 2 years ago this was a mistake, or next year you have a new governor and you want to fix it then. It's too late for some children. The wiring is happening now. And if they're pulled out of a quality environment and those things don't happen, those children don't get another chance. And New Horizon isn't the only one. There are a lot of providers in this room that would have to stop serving these families or would close programs if you do this. And I know there's a ton of them over here, but there are many more throughout Minnesota. Please don't make this mistake. I know you have a crisis situation, and you've had it year after year after year. And when I said that child care has been damaged year after year, we've never actually cut rates. We've frozen rates. Costs of care have gone up over these last 9 years, and we haven't kept up, and that's already a problem. But this is the first time ever, since I can ever remember, that we actually say we want to cut reimbursement rates based on a market in 2001. So this is, you got problems, I get it, but this will cause permanent damage for a lot of reasons, so please reconsider.
Well, thank you. I think your testimony is very compelling. I hope, can you send this to us on a PDF?
I will. This other picture, by the way, is a three-year-old's brain in a good, healthy environment. The bottom picture is a brain that's not been in a healthy environment. There's evidence. There's evidence everywhere, so we don't have the excuse that this isn't the right thing to do.
That's when Dr. Anda comes, that's a lot of what he talks about. So the members are all invited next Wednesday to that. I detect a little more edginess in your voice this year. I know it's... am I off on that? No. It is tough, but, you know, we need... and I guess as a chair, what I would like to say is your message needs to get to legislators, and I hope you will help it get to all of you, to your own legislator. That's the most important thing. That's what we're trained to listen to, is our own constituents. So coming here is a big step. It's, I think, for us, members, this is the testimony is very, it's always been compelling, but it seems, you know, you're making a good, really strong case. We need to continue to pay attention to that, and then we need your help to make sure other legislators understand what this cut means. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have a little under 15 minutes left. We're going to get through the last three, Sharna and Stephanie and Melinda, if you can all come down. And we'll try to end right at 6, but we want to make sure you have enough time. Welcome to the committee if you'd like to proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Sharna Brox. I'm with the YMCA of Greater St. Paul, and I represent all of the child care programs that they offer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I'm Stephanie Thomas, and I work with Metropolitan Minneapolis YMCA, and we're here speaking today representing the YMCAs within Greater Minnesota and the metropolitan area. We wanted to thank you for allowing us to speak today on behalf of the children and families of Minnesota that depend on the YMCA for their care and safety. We want to focus our remarks really on the proposal for the reduction of child care assistance for proprietor pay rates and the proposed reduction to the basic sliding fee child care assistance. We believe that there is potential that sliding fee child care assistance. We believe that there is potential that this will devastate the families that we serve and the communities that we serve. We believe that the cuts will, or the reductions will, really impact the Minnesota families by closing YMCA child care centers, creating job loss in the industry, and for the families in Minnesota. The YMCA is the largest non-for-profit child care provider in the United States. The YMCA strives to build strong kids, strong families, and strong communities in all that we do. We have different service options, which are infant, toddler, preschool, partial preschool, school-age care, and summer options. The parents that look for the YMCA, they look for nurturing environments that their children can get strong curriculum and prepare them for the future. The YMCA experience carries four core values: caring, honesty, respect, and responsibility. These components are what the YMCA has based their programming on for 150 years, and it's made us a leader in the child care industry. Throughout Minneapolis and St. Paul, the YMCA child care systems, we employ close to 1,000 employees within child care itself. In Minnesota, over 20,000 children that qualify for child care assistance are served in YMCA programs. We currently have three centers within the metropolitan Minneapolis and St. Paul areas that serve 90% child care assistance and Y scholarship funded families. That funding allows families to have safe, high quality nurturing care so their children for their children so that they can go to work or go to school to improve their family's life. Child care assistance in the funding has really offered families in Minnesota the opportunity to receive high quality care that does not discriminate by the income of their family. With the proposed budget cuts or reductions, we will be creating an unfair playing field for the families of Minnesota. Child care providers cannot maintain the level of care on reduced rates. Centers will be forced to lower the enrollment of government-funded children in the centers or cut quality in hours and staffing. If families don't have equal access to the quality care, we will see an increase in children being home left alone, left in the care of other children, or balanced between emergency care systems. Many families will be forced with the decision of unsafe care options or losing their employment. These proposed cuts will eliminate already limited options for parents when it comes to their child care. For the YMCA, it is our mission to not turn families away due to their financial status. But continuing to accept these families at a lower rate, the YMCA is proposed to lose about $400,000, a loss we simply can't absorb. We have the three centers in areas that are in desperate need for quality care. These cuts would force the YMCA to look at closing those centers, leaving few options for parents in need and cutting jobs in those low-income areas. The reality for many families at our centers is that they need to be at child care centers that work for public transportation. If centers in the communities close, the lack of stable child care would force those families into unemployment.
We would also like to address that a decrease in child care assistance will affect parent copays. Many families cannot afford their current copays. At the YMCA, we are providing scholarships and financial assistance to those families to help them cover the cost not covered by the government funding. In 2009, the YMCAs in Minnesota awarded over $1 million in financial assistance to families so that they may receive quality care for their children. Currently, over 2,000 families the YMCA serves are receiving financial assistance over and above the state support. This is a massive hit to the financially to YMCAs. We expect record levels of assistance throughout 2010. By decreasing the child care assistance, what you are really doing is increasing the amount the YMCA will need to cover with financial assistance. YMCA volunteers in your communities are working hard to solicit donations to help with these circumstances. But increasing needs and competition for donation dollars make fundraising increasingly challenging. Many funders are already letting us know about future downsizing of grants and assistance. That leads to our last point, that much of what we cannot cover, much that cannot be covered by government funding or scholarships is written off in bad debt and is a loss to the YMCA. These are accounts where families are unable to pay for services that they've already received. The highest percentage of families who incur this bad debt are families receiving child care assistance funding or financial assistance. Currently, copays are often not realistic for family budgets. Last year, the YMCAs in Minnesota incurred over $300,000 in bad debt. This is a direct loss of revenue for the program and must be absorbed by the organization in some way. We expect an increase in this number if these cuts go through. This would mean considerable cuts to the YMCA in programming and job loss. We know that you care about the children and families in your district just as we do, and that you have some very difficult decisions to make as you try and balance the state's budget. But we implore you to put the future of our children and the jobs for our families to the top of the list of priorities and not accept this proposal to reduce child care assistance or reduce the basic sliding fee child care assistance. Child care has gone without appropriate funding for years, and to reduce what funding is there would be a travesty to this profession and our state's children. Currently, Minnesota is working hard to increase the quality of care across the state to offer every child a healthy start. These proposed cuts make that equality impossible. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about the YMCA's passion for caring for children and our commitment to our families and communities. We hope we have made a case for you that these proposed budget cuts leads to no wins. Our children lose, our families lose, our communities lose, and as a state, we are severely weakened. Thank you.
Thank you. If we could also get a copy of your testimony. I have a question. So $300,000 with bad debt. So a family starts, the CCAP payments are coming in, they're not really paying their co-pays, and then what, 6 months you kick them off, or how long?
Madam Chair, depending on the co-pays, it depends. So how the length of time that they would be with our program before that total debt would incur. But we look at that over a total year. So when we are serving thousands of families on assistance, it doesn't take long to for that debt to rise quickly. But yes, most of it is from co-pays.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Our last testifier, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I'm just going to slide over here for a second. My name is Melinda Hugdahl. I'm a staff attorney with the Legal Services Advocacy Project in St. Paul. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak, and I also wanted to say thank you, too, for the commitment and the work of this committee, and I know there are several related committees, several of you were on, that have really made a good commitment to child care and low-income families over the years, and we very much appreciate that work and the willingness to listen to the issues for our clients over time, and it's very much appreciated. I would also like to indicate, too, that we echo the comments the other presenters have made. I don't want to duplicate the comments that have already been made. But obviously, a lot of the issues they've talked about are direct impacts on our clients who all are all low income. So a lot of those issues are issues that our clients are going to see as well. The subgroup that I want to talk about specifically was the group impacted by this SSI change that the assistant commissioner talked about. I want to highlight those families. They're small in number, but they have a significant need. From what we know, these are primarily working families. They're either directly working or they are in work authorized activities who are still low income and have a disabled family member living in the household. These vulnerable families may be a single parent with a disabled child or a two-parent family where one parent is disabled. In either case, these are families with a person with a significant disability that's been recognized by SSI, which if any of you have worked in that area, that is no small task to get SSI up and running and rolling for these families. I also wanted to indicate that really from our perspective, the purpose of SSI is to cover expenses related to the disability. It is not intended to cover things like child care and rent and other essentials. That's what income and, if needed, other programs are supposed to cover. SSI is intended for expenses related to the disability. And a lot of these families have a limited pie, so to speak, of income. They'll have some income, they have SSI, they may have some other benefits, and if you start taking from one place, you're looking at it from another. And for those on MFIP, under this proposal, they'd also be seeing a grant reduction in their MFIP benefit as well. So some of these families are going to be hit in multiple places. But what is the impact generally? And as the assistant commissioner has indicated, this cut's going to result in some families seeing a higher co-payment, and other families are going to lose child care assistance altogether. For all these families, this is a significant loss. And those who are receiving MFIP are also, again, going to see that grant reduced as well. We're concerned that some of these vulnerable families are not going to be able to continue working. The costs and are just going to be too much. And as the other presenters have talked about those challenges for these families, we're very concerned about the choices that they may be left with, and some of them may exit the workforce. These families are some of our most vulnerable families. They're trying to make ends meet. They're meeting requirements for work or work-approved activities, but they're still low income. These reductions are only placing further stress on these vulnerable families, and we just want to have members keep in mind that these, like I said, they're a small group, a small subset, but they're a really important subset and have some very unique challenges for them.
Thank you. If you could get us, when you say it's a small group, I guess I would like some follow-up on how small, how many people is this, and then I would appreciate mm-hmm. a couple case studies. You know, what is the SSI income versus, you know, kind of, And then what's the childcare grant? Now, if that's counting towards their income, you know, it's hard for us to connect the dots on all these.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's obviously a big change for people and not going to help them, but it's in my mind, just getting straight exactly if we had a couple, maybe family A, family B, how it affects their finances, so we could understand. And I know, members, we all know it's tough out there. I mean, if you have $100 less a month, you don't. What do you not get your groceries, or you know, what do you do? But is it $100 a month? If you could give us something more specific, I think it would help me at least articulate this better.
Sure, Madam Chair. Yes, I can look at that, and I know the Assistant Commissioner, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but as I looked at it, the number of families that see increased copay under this subset is 800 families, and I think it was about 160 families would likely be off of assistance altogether. I think that's my understanding of the numbers, but
okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Welcome.
With that, members, we will meet on Tuesday. We have the national speaker in that day who will talk about the national funding of early childhood. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.